Good morning. Thank you for joining us for this meeting of the Legislative Energy Commission. I don't believe we have a quorum, but we don't need a quorum because we don't plan to conduct any business. But we are going to hear about biogas today. We are starting, I believe, exactly 25 minutes late, so we are going to run 25 minutes over. But we will try to make up time during the morning. Everybody has a certain allocated amount of time, and when your allocated amount of time is up, then we'll move on to the next person because I know people have other things that they need to get to. So, Amanda, I don't know how to pronounce your last name, so welcome Billick to the committee.
Okay, great. My name is Amanda Billick. I went to Great Plains Institute. Thank you very much for the invitation to present before the commission this morning on a topic that I've really worked deeply on the last 12 years or so, and that is biogas. There are some interesting activities that are happening in this space. And so the timing is really good to be having this discussion today. So my role this morning is to really help set the stage for the rest of the discussion and the other presentations you'll be hearing this morning. I won't get too deep in any one of these particular topic areas, but I hopefully will provide you with a good of enough introduction to the different concepts and models that will allow my fellow presenters to go a little bit deeper in depth on some specific projects. So I'm going to spend just a minute talking about my own experience and about my organization, the Great Plains Institute, do a little bit of overview of some of the basics around biogas production and technology, talk about some of the benefits and the challenges, the status of Minnesota projects, and then look at some international experience for biogas development as well as some experience from other U.S. states, and then conclude by talking about some future trends. So the Great Plains Institute is a 15-year-old nonpartisan nonprofit organization, and our mission is to transform the production, distribution, and consumption of energy to be both economically and environmentally sustainable over time. So I've been working on biogas systems in a variety of different capacities over the last 12 years or so. My introduction to biogas was serving as the coordinator for an interdisciplinary team of researchers that were made up of the University of Minnesota and some local units of government. And this team helped study some of the economic and environmental benefits of Minnesota's first on-farm biogas project at the Hob and Shield Dairy in Princeton, Minnesota. The project was installed in 1999, and I helped coordinate the research teams beginning in 2002 through about 2006. I've also consulted with various biogas projects in and outside of Minnesota. I mostly have a public policy background, not an engineering background, but you will be hearing from other engineers this morning. Through my public policy work, I have also authored the development of several reports and fact sheets as well as web resources. And I've also had the opportunity to travel internationally to learn about biogas development in other countries, in particular Germany, where I completed an environmental policy fellowship last year, or in 2012. So a little bit on the basics. A good place to start this morning is just with some definitions of some of the different terms that you'll be hearing several times this morning. First, anaerobic digestion is defined as a series of biological processes in which microorganisms break down biodegradable materials in the absence of oxygen. The anaerobic digestion process results in the production of biogas. And then biogas is a mixture of mostly methane and carbon dioxide, and then there are some other trace gases present in biogas. Landfill gas has a similar composition to biogas that is generated through anaerobic digestion. But landfill gas applications essentially close existing landfills to capture the gas, and as the solid waste starts to break down, the enclosed landfills create an oxygen-free environment. And then gas is extracted using a series of wells and a blower system or a vacuum system to move that gas to a central point where it can be processed for other end uses like electricity production. Renewable natural gas is raw biogas that has been cleaned to a specification that makes it interchangeable with conventional natural gas. So this means that the carbon dioxide and other trace gases are removed from the raw biogas to have a product that is about 95, 97, 98% methane. Renewable natural gas is also, or has been, commonly referred to as biomethane. I think the renewable natural gas term is a little bit preferred because it is more intuitive in its interchangeability with conventional natural gas. So to produce biogas, you can really take any organic material, like manure, crop residues, wastewater, fats, oils, greases, and then process them in the oxygen-free environment of an anaerobic digester. Heat and bacteria help to break down the organic material, and as it breaks down, the biogas is collected, and then it can be processed for a variety of end-use applications. And when organic material is processed through anaerobic digestion, the nutrient value, the nitrogen and the phosphorus that's present in the raw organic feedstocks, is still present in the digested material. Recovery of those nutrients can really be a key to the economic and environmental attributes of some biogas projects. It's also important to understand that different organic feedstocks produce different amounts of biogas. Manure actually produces the least amount of biogas compared to other organic feedstocks. So you can see that from the chart towards the bottom. Fats, oils, and greases produce the highest amount of biogas per ton of feedstock. So some projects have begun to combine a high biogas volume feedstock, like fats or greases, with a lower volume feedstock to maximize overall biogas production. I would also categorize various biogas applications under four sort of broad categories. So there's agricultural, and this can include manure-based projects, but can also include projects that digest agricultural outputs, like waste material from food or cheese processing. There's also an industrial category, and this category might have some overlap with agricultural applications, like a food processing plant. But industrial applications might integrate anaerobic digestion into an industrial process, to provide a source of process energy, such as in a pulp and paper facility, or even in a brewery operation that produces beer. Wastewater treatment is another category. There are many wastewater treatment facilities that already use anaerobic digestion to treat biosolids and wastewater. And then there's also landfills, which don't use separate anaerobic digestion technology, but they do have a similar gas makeup to other biogas applications that do use standalone anaerobic digestion technology. So there are four basic categories as well for different types of anaerobic digestion technology. The first are covered anaerobic lagoons. These are the least capital intensive, and they essentially place a seal over existing lagoons with a flexible cover. However, these systems are most efficient in warmer climates, since you need additional heat to still have the bacteria working. So we don't really see these types of applications in Minnesota, since they're not very efficient 4 to 6, maybe sometimes 7 months out of the year. Plug flow digesters are long, narrow concrete tanks that have a rigid or a flexible cover. The tank is partially built above ground or below ground or fully below ground to limit any demand for supplemental heat. Minnesota's current on-farm projects do use plug flow technology. Most plug flows do not have like an internal mechanical system that helps to move the feedstocks through the system. There is a technology provider that's based in Wisconsin that does have what they call a modified plug flow, and this does have an internal mechanical system that helps move materials through different chambers of the plug flow system. And I believe that Minnesota has 3 installations of this Wisconsin technology. And in your packet and available in the handouts on the table is a pretty good, a great report from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture detailing a lot of Minnesota's on-farm biogas projects. So the next category is a complete mix digester, and this is an above-ground enclosed heated tank that does have an internal mixing mechanism. So the picture on the top right shows kind of the internal, the inside of a complete mix digester with the mechanical equipment that's used to mix the organic feedstocks. And the fourth category is dry digestion systems, sometimes referred to as dry fermentation. These systems are also upright and above ground systems, similar to a complete mix. They're made of concrete and steel, and they have a rigid cover. These digesters operate at more into feedstock sources that are 20 to 42% solids, whereas complete mix and plug flow might be in the range of 8 to 15% solids. So dry digestion systems can process materials that are have high dry matter, like poultry manure or crop residues, or source-separated organics. And the schematic on this slide is for a dry digestion system. This is actually a company that is based in Wisconsin called BioFirm. And they have their technology roots in Germany, but they do have an office in Madison. And there are at least two dry digestion systems operational in Wisconsin that I know of, and I don't think any in Minnesota that I'm aware of. So that once you have your collected biogas through your anaerobic digestion, there are multiple end-use applications. This is a great distinguishing feature of biogas compared to other types of renewable energy resources. Biogas can be produced nearly 24 hours a day as long as you have a consistent and reliable feedstock supply. And the end use, the flexibility in the end use of the biogas really sets it apart. It can be used to produce electricity, a source of heat, or combined heat and power. You can clean up the gas, as I mentioned, into renewable natural gas. You can also clean it and compress it for use as transportation fuel in compressed natural gas vehicles. So I would say in Minnesota, we really have a track record of previous projects that have focused on producing electricity from biogas. But because of its biogas's flexibility in providing thermal energy or a replacement or integration with conventional natural gas or even transportation fuel, a focus on electricity-only utilization might really overlook the highest and best use of biogas. So as we move forward and we have these discussions, I think that all utilization options should really be a part of the discussion, and I would encourage us to look a bit more at some of the other markets that might have a higher value for the biogas resource, like the transportation fuel market in the form of compressed natural gas, bio-based compressed natural gas. There are also emerging utilization opportunities in the high-value chemicals or products market. So renewable natural gas can serve any market or application that currently uses conventional natural gas as a feedstock. So an example of this might be a chemical process that is producing industrial plastics, for instance. And then finally, this schematic is a bit gets a little squished, but just wanted to show that there is available technology and processes in place that really are available, technically available, to be able to clean up biogas to renewable natural gas. The economics of these projects are difficult, and we'll hear more about that this morning from some other of the other presenters, but there is commercially available technology that does make this technically feasible. So just to look at some of the benefits, biogas really does have multiple environmental benefits. Processing the organic materials in an anaerobic digestion system can help stabilize the nitrogen and phosphorus that's available in the raw feedstocks. Those nutrients can be recovered through additional processing, and their technology can help can work to isolate some of those nutrients to make fertilizer products for land application. The use of heat in anaerobic digestion does help to reduce pathogens that are present in raw feedstocks. And since methane that would otherwise be released during natural decomposition is captured, biogas energy systems result in overall reduced carbon emissions. There are also some water quality benefits that could be realized through implementation of biogas energy systems, as long as they're paired with good management practices. And as long as there are additional technology or methods in place that help to recover those nutrients, either through fertilizer products, and once those nutrients become a little bit more mobile, if there are watersheds that have an impairment for a certain nutrient, those materials could be exported outside of the watershed into areas that might have nutrient deficiencies in other areas. There are also some economic benefits for biogas projects. And for the most part, currently operational biogas projects have to be able to quantify some of these potential benefits beyond just energy sales in order to really make their projects economically feasible. The sale of energy alone is not usually enough to make a project work economically. This is also one of the biggest challenges of biogas systems. Some projects might be able to quantify some savings from avoided waste disposal costs. There might be monetization of some environmental attributes, like carbon emission reductions. These are available in some markets. And then nutrient recovery might provide some additional revenue stream for projects. So just a little bit about some of the challenges. There have been many challenges for some of the biogas projects. And it's a reason why we probably haven't seen a tremendous uptake of biogas energy systems. Some of those challenges are that bacteria that is needed to help break down the systems really need to have a consistent and reliable source of feedstock. And if there are seasonal feedstocks, like from canning operations, that can really limit the availability or the ability of projects to work. Because we're talking about different feedstock sources for these types of projects, permitting can be a little bit more complicated and require different permitting for each individual project. And because there is not a really good infrastructure or service technicians to help facilities or individual producers that might implement these systems, taking on the responsibility and the risk of managing these biological systems that have an energy component can also be a limiting factor. And I would say that compared to some of the other renewable energy sources, there is a little less public policy support. And when there is public policy support, for instance, at the federal level, for tax credits, for instance, it might only be allowable or eligible sources for electricity production, but not for, like, renewable natural gas. So that also limits the availability of projects. So a little bit, despite some of these challenges, there are some operational projects in Minnesota, which is great to see. So the following maps are static maps that are really pulled from an interactive map that's available through the American Biogas Council. And as you click on some of the different projects online, you're able to get a little more information about some of the projects. So I've included links to where the maps are available if you want to explore the database yourself. So in Minnesota, the agricultural operations are at dairy farms and all are producing electricity with the biogas that is collected from the digestion system. And the report from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture has a lot more detail on those systems. Several wastewater treatment facilities in Minnesota do have anaerobic digestion systems. There is some variability if the wastewater treatment plant is using the biogas for on-site electricity or heating needs, or if they're simply flaring it because energy generation is not economically feasible. But there are operational anaerobic digestion systems. And then there are about 8 operational landfill gas projects in Minnesota. And according to the EPA Landfill Methane Outreach Program, they estimate there's another 3 to 4 landfills that are candidates for future landfill gas projects. So data on industrial applications is a little bit harder to come by. An example of an industrial application might be the Liberty Paper Plant in Becker that has an operational anaerobic digestion system. I think that right now, some other speakers will talk a little more about this. They're flaring their gas that's collected. But biofuel production facilities could be another source of industrial applications that could integrate anaerobic digestion and use part of the biogas that's collected to help meet a portion of their process energy needs. So just transitioning to look at some international experience, Germany in these discussions is often looked to as the international leader in the development of biogas energy systems. By the end of 2012, they had about a little over 7,500 biogas plants that were operating in Germany. And this was about an installed electrical capacity of around 3.3 gigawatts of electrical power. They also had, in addition to that, they have 116 renewable natural gas plants that were already feeding into the natural gas grid in Germany. And as this commission has talked about and has been written about extensively, Germany has implemented some specific policy interventions that have helped to grow the development of their renewable resources, and biogas is no exception to that. So as where the previous slide kind of showed the table of the overall number and the energy capacity of the biogas industry, these maps really show the distribution of biogas plant locations throughout the country. It's pretty dense, as you can see from the map. And in recent years, Germany has made a transition with their public policy support to help support projects that do produce renewable natural gas and put that into the natural gas distribution system. The map on the right shows the location of those renewable natural gas projects. This map is a bit old, but current information, this map says there's 83, but current information, according to the German Biogas Council, is there are actually 116 operational renewable natural gas projects in Germany. So the biogas industry in Germany really saw some explosive growth between 2000 and 2010 due to the generous energy purchase rates. Recent updates to Germany's energy policy has really started to decrease those guaranteed rates for future projects. Policy reforms are already being implemented that are focusing more on the digestion of waste feedstocks. Much of the current biogas production in Germany is actually using corn silage The stock, the cob, the kernel, in a lot of instances, is a high BTU content, so it's attractive for those projects. And I would say that overall, the German biogas experience really offers some lessons and also maybe some cautions for other jurisdictions as they develop our own biogas resource. Another country that has been aggressively pursuing biogas production is Sweden. And this is a slide that was reproduced with permission from the Swedish Energy Agency. Sweden has taken an integrated approach, really, to waste management for energy production. About 10 to 15 years ago, they implemented some various measures to help boost biogas production in the country. And by 2018, Sweden estimates that it will digest about 40% of all organic waste from households as well as commercial facilities.
Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question to the testifier. Your previous slide just said there were 7,500 methane digesters that were also producing gas and then injecting some into the system. Mm-hmm. What percentage would you say of the total gas consumption is produced through those 7,500 digesters for the country of Germany?
For the country of Germany? because most of it is for electricity production of those 7,500, so the 116 that are doing gas production, it's in the range of 1 to 2%. So in Sweden, instead of focusing on electricity generation as the utilization of biogas and then trying to pivot to renewable natural gas production like Germany is currently doing, Sweden has really started out by focusing on using biogas as a transportation resource. And in Sweden, they have really taken the approach of blending renewable natural gas into their conventional natural gas distribution system. And so what comes out the other end is just a blend of those two, and they are using the blended gas to help fuel some of their vehicles. Right now, it's only about 1% of their light vehicle market is powered by this blended gas. There's about 2,000 buses, though, that run on gas. That's about 15% of their total market. And then it's about another 2% of the total truck and light truck, heavy truck and light truck market. They've also built out about 150 public refueling stations. So individual consumers or fleet operators are able to fuel up their CNG vehicles. So during a trade mission to Northern Europe last summer, Governor Dayton did sign a memorandum of understanding with Sweden on bioenergy cooperation. The MOU does cover all bioenergy development, but an area of near-term focus is on biogas cooperation to really learn from Sweden on what they have done around using some of their waste resources for to meet transportation needs. In May of this year, Minnesota hosted a group of Swedish officials to learn more about Sweden's success in waste management for biogas production to help serve transportation markets. Great Plains Institute helped organize this event, and we also had individual meetings with the Metropolitan Council, the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, as well as the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board for the 7-county metro area. And these conversations helped to learn a little bit more from Sweden's experience and identify if there are some future collaboration opportunities. And slides from the event at the American Swedish Institute are available on our website, and I've included the link in the slides. So transitioning from the international experience to look a little bit closer to home to some of the experience from other U.S. states. When it comes to the area of agriculture-based biogas systems, a clear U.S. leader in this field is Wisconsin. They have the greatest number of installed ag-based biogas systems of any other U.S. state. And there are several different reasons for this that has contributed to their success. Beginning in 2003-2004, they ran a state grant program that helped cover 25% of installed project costs for these projects. They also, in 2001, formed a biogas roundtable, which really brought together folks from the Department of Agriculture, other state agencies, other stakeholders, including producers, government officials, non-governmental organizations and utilities, and technology developers to help share some successes and challenges when it came to trying trying to implement more of these projects has really been a positive forum for sharing information and connecting people with one another to help develop projects. Some electric utilities did implement voluntary tariffs for the purchase of biogas-based electricity from different projects. Most of those tariffs have been phased out. They also had some standard interconnection agreements for biogas to electricity projects that helped to facilitate the ability of these projects to get their electricity sold into the distribution of the transmission system. And then they also have, they started with one local technology provider that was based in the state, and now they have at least two. There might be others that have set up installations. But having a technology provider that's in your state can provide some assurance to projects that are looking at wanting to implement these projects that there will be somebody that they can call that will help service the system when things go wrong and if something breaks down. Another effort that Wisconsin did a couple years ago, they contracted with a private company to develop an online interactive map to really assess some of their different opportunities for further agriculture biogas applications. So this map allows you to kind of turn on and off different layers. It includes information on the natural gas pipeline infrastructure in the state. It has the different utility substations, electric service territory, and then it's really focused on the options of individual dairy farms, as well as dairy processing plants, to look at different feedstock sources that are available. In this static map, I kind of put on all the layers so you can see how complicated it might look. But if you take off the information on some of the electric utility and natural gas information, they have where there are feedstocks available within 20 or 30 miles of different plants that could be co-located, co-digested for individual biogas applications. Iowa has also created a similar type of interactive biogas development map. A similar type of activity like this could be done in Minnesota. It hasn't been done to date. The Iowa map is a little bit more robust than the Wisconsin map. This particular iteration of the map shows potential biogas production kind of broken down by township. So the darker areas of the map have a greater amount of biogas production potential because they might have more agriculture residue or dairy manure or swine manure or food processing facilities. Other layers of the map that you can turn on and off include other types of livestock like chicken or beef operations. There's ethanol and biodiesel plant information. Their paper manufacturing, landfill transfer stations, wastewater treatment, as well as all of the utility information in addition to the natural gas pipelines. It's very robust and a really great resource for the state of Iowa. So moving a little bit from the art of the possible to some examples of actual operations, these are outside of Minnesota, but an interesting industrial application is actually POET had a grand opening earlier this month for a 25 million gallon per year cellulosic ethanol facility in Emmitsburg, Iowa. And this POET has integrated an on-site anaerobic digestion system that uses some of the processed wastewater from the cellulosic ethanol production, in addition to a solid fuel boiler that combusts some of the Stover stillage from the production process. And this meets all of the process energy needs for the cellulosic ethanol facility. And this cellulosic facility is also co-located with an existing corn ethanol facility. So some of the biogas is actually moved, piped across the street to the corn ethanol facility to meet a portion of their process energy needs. Fun examples are breweries. And this is the New Belgium Brewery in Fort Collins, Colorado. They are another, these types of systems are another opportunity for industrial applications. And we have a great craft beer industry that's sprouting up in Minnesota that could take advantage of some of these to make the system overall and the production process more efficient. New Belgium treats some of the wastewater from the brewing process in a series of anaerobic and aerobic lagoons, and they use that to produce electricity and recover some of their heat, and this meets about 15% of their process energy needs. Another example from a dairy is actually a large dairy in Indiana that is displacing about 1.5 million gallons of diesel fuel per year. They're cleaning up their gas, they're putting it into the natural gas pipeline, and then Clean Energy, which is a company that is actually owned by T. Boone Pickens, has put in a fueling station near the dairy that also helps to provide refueling for municipal vehicles. And it's a mixture, the gas that comes out of the end, the compressed natural gas that comes out of the end, is a mixture of either conventional or renewable natural gas. The final example is from Ohio, and this is at a Quasar Energy Group facility at a municipal wastewater treatment plant that treats the biosolids as well as any food processing waste. And they're producing about 3,600 gasoline gallon equivalents per day from the renewable natural gas. So just in wrapping up with a couple future trends for this industry, central or regional systems that start to aggregate multiple feedstock sources are definitely not the norm in this industry right now, but recent years have seen the installation of more of these types of systems. This really helps to maximize biogas production by mixing maybe a lower biogas production resource with a higher biogas production feedstock. An example of this type of project, of this regional or central system, is the Hometown Bioenergy Project in Le Sueur, Minnesota. The other big trend in the industry is what I've talked about a lot this morning, and that is the use of biogas as a transportation fuel. Upgrading and compressing raw biogas for use as a transportation fuel has been the biggest area of growth for biogas projects in recent years that I have seen. And the biggest driver for this growth has been the Federal Renewable Fuel Standard. The Renewable Fuel Standard was enacted in 2007, and it sets a national goal of 36 billion gallons of renewable fuel production by 2022. And then eligible renewable fuels are divided into four categories. There's the renewable fuel, which is most is with corn ethanol. There's a cellulosic pool, an advanced biofuel pool, as well as biodiesel. And biogas was included as an advanced biofuel when the law was first enacted in 2007. The RFS, the Renewable Fuel Standard, does provide an economic incentive for biogas-based fuel because projects sell compliance credits to show compliance with the Renewable Fuel Standard. And the value of those credits has kind of ranged from 40 to 60 cents, maybe sometimes a little bit higher, per gallon of biogas-based fuel. And in July of this past year, the Environmental Protection Agency issued an updated rule that also allows biogas that's produced from landfills or wastewater treatment or agriculture operations or the organic portion of municipal solid waste to also sell compliance credits in the cellulosic pool. And that is a much larger pool that has had some trouble meeting the yearly volume requirements. And so there, it's anticipated that this will also provide an even greater economic incentive for moving more biogas projects into the transportation market. And bio-based compressed natural gas do offer significant greenhouse gas emission reductions on a life cycle basis compared to gasoline or conventional natural gas. As seen in this chart, landfill and dairy biogas that's compressed offer deep reductions, but renewable natural gas from high-strength feedstocks like food waste or fats, oils, and potentially greases actually have a negative carbon intensity life cycle. And those would all be sources that would qualify under the EPA Renewable Fuel Standard. And this is already happening. In the last year, in 2013, there were a total of 25 million gallons that were generated in 2013 from biogas-based fuel that were used to help comply with the Renewable Fuel Standard. And with the allowance of also these producers being able to sell cellulosic credits under the standard, it is anticipated that we will see even higher numbers in 2014. And the final trend and opportunity that I wanted to just mention was that as we kind of move towards thinking about diverting source-separated organics out of the solid waste stream into with separate collection efforts, there's some discussion happening already underway in the metro area, that these types of efforts could also be integrated with anaerobic digestion technology, and to use these resources to also help meet energy needs and maybe local community energy needs. Oh, I got a little behind. Sorry about that. So in summary, I just want to, biogas development is really a growth opportunity for Minnesota. The constant and flexible nature of the resource makes it an attractive resource. But there are significant challenges that need to be overcome. Discussions like this are a great place to start, and we could even be putting more effort behind this resource by assembling stakeholders to think creatively about how to overcome some of those challenges. We could also be doing some more work on assessing our biogas resource, maybe with some of those maps, the examples I showed from Wisconsin and Minnesota. Our neighboring states and other U.S. states are actively pursuing the development of their biogas resources, and Minnesota has a similar opportunity, and we should really work to take advantage of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Wagenius.
Not so much a question, but something that would be helpful as we go forward with this would be an analysis of how, where we could develop biogas and it would be really helpful with our water problems, and I can see that maybe in wastewater treatment, and some places where we could go forward with biogas and it actually could exacerbate our nitrogen problems. So it seems to me that that's the next layer of analysis that we need, so that we are choosing to work on those things that are helpful. I mean, since you can't do everything, why not go down the path where we can actually help with our water problems? So I would hope that that would be a layer of analysis that this committee could take on in the next. That's okay.
Sounds good. Ms. Billick,
Am
I saying that right?
Yeah. I would say that is a valuable contribution to thinking about, you know, if there is some sort of mapping resource, that could be a layer of kind of doing that analysis to help figure, because part of the mapping, the intent behind the mapping is to help cite projects. And so we want to cite those projects in areas where they can be the most helpful.
Well, excuse me.
Representative Wagenius.
Okay, but that's only getting at part of the problem. I mean, part of the problem is if we use a feedstock that is going to require us to put even more nitrogen on the land, then we're exacerbating our nitrogen problem. If we use a feedstock like wastewater treatment and we can take out the nitrogen, we would be actually solving a problem, say the one we have at Pig's Eye, our plant there, is not dealing with nitrogen well. So we, you know, it's hard for me to figure out exactly what's the best direction without that layer of analysis.
Sure. Understood.
Further member questions? Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Billick. I tend to be kind of a finance guy and numbers guy, and so I'm inquiring about two questions specifically. Do you know what the cost is for generation of the bio natural gas or biogas in general? And the second part of that question is, currently, do you know what percentage of the market of energy is produced by biogas?
Just to clarify, so the overall kind of market in Minnesota or nationally?
Anything that you might have.
Yeah, I would say that the overall market, it's really small. I mean, probably less than 1%. Both if you, and this is probably nationwide. With Minnesota, it might be even less than that. It might be microscopic. And later, Pete Klein from the St. Paul Port Authority, who's the VP of Finance, is going to talk about some of the economic issues. But with some of the analysis looking at renewable natural gas, and Pat Hurl from Burns McDonald will talk about this too, some of the internal analysis that other groups have looked at, you know, for these projects on a particular cost basis to be able to do this, you need about $10 per MMBTU. The current way that it looks without, and that's why the quantification of some of those other benefits is really necessary to make these projects happen.
Thank you.
Could you know, I'd just like to take care of something that's really a distraction for me from this hearing. So the person who's here from the Minnesota Jobs Coalition to take pictures of me, if you just want to get a few and then leave so that I could focus on the presentations, that would be fine. You want me to smile? Would you like me to stand? Since I know you're taking pictures for the attack literature that will be coming in my district, it's very hard to concentrate while you're taking pictures. So would you like me to pose for any, or is there any way I can help you?
Is it her? I'm not taking pictures of you.
It's me.
It's her.
All right, just as long as we're all clear on what's going on here in the background. Any other questions for the presenter?
I thought there was just a lot of interest in biogas.
It's a really ugly time of year. There's a lot of publicly available pictures of us that are perfectly suitable for attack literature. I think we'll move on then to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Thank you.
Of course she does, Madam Chair.
Senator Senjum.
I'm sorry, and thank you, Ms. Okay. Ms. Billick. Fascinating presentation. Are you familiar at all, because I'm just very superficially familiar with at least my, I'll call them the big cow people in my district or my area. And when I talk to them about this, and they've got, massive amounts of manure to manage. They have to buy a lot of land or find a lot of land to distribute it on. But that still seems to be a better choice than anaerobic digestion because I think they worry about the technology. They worry about, the maintenance, the oversight on that piece of equipment, whether or not they're going to have to hire maybe three additional technicians 24/7, 7 days a week, all of that. Do you have any sense of where the ag industry is on thought with respect to this?
Well, I think there are some opportunities, but I think that those challenges that you just laid out are the challenges that the ag industry is concerned about, and that just as someone who is a proponent of biogas projects is also concerned about. We need, qualified service technicians, maybe some sort of a model that would be a third-party own, operate, and build for agriculture producers might be something worth looking at. There have been some experimentation with some of those models in other states where a company comes in, builds the project, essentially is buying the value of the manure from the producer, and then they still are able to have the digested manure available as a nutrient for reapplication on their fields. But until we can kind of figure out how we can service some of these systems and to ease some of those concerns, I think that will continue to limit the adoption.
Thank you.
Any other questions before we go to the next presentation? Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the case of Sweden, where they're using a lot of food waste, are they using primarily industrial food waste, that's part of the processing, or are they also collecting household food waste?
Yeah. So current applications actually are really focused on municipal wastewater treatment facilities. So that's their primary feedstock source right now. They're moving towards wanting to digest more food waste. They have implemented collection programs from households to collect food waste, source-separated organics at the household level, as well as from restaurants and smaller commercial institutions. There's smaller penetration of those feedstocks right now in the Swedish industry, but that is definitely an area of growth that they're working on in the upcoming years.
Anyone else? Thank you very
much.
Thank you. It was a great overview. Welcome to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tim Farnan. I work in the Sustainable Materials Management Unit over at the Pollution Control Agency, and with me today is my colleague Bruce Broughton. Bruce is a principal engineer who works on air permits. And we have some fairly brief remarks today. I'm just going to start with a few general comments, and then Bruce will address some of these specific air considerations that we think you might be interested in. Ms. Billick from the Great Plains Institute did a wonderful job of explaining the diversity of technologies that are a part of creating biogas, and that, of course, creates a complex array of questions with respect to the environmental impacts. So each technology is unique, and each one has its own benefits and risks. And, of course, these different technologies are using different feedstocks, and that raises different considerations with each type of feedstock. In Minnesota, we are definitely further along with the agricultural applications of this technology. We've got some digesters, as she noted, using manures or wastewater treatment plants using biogas. We do not yet have any facilities in Minnesota that are using source-separated organics or food wastes to create biogas. So that's sort of an emerging technology and an emerging process here in the state of Minnesota. We do think that well-run facilities can have some environmental benefits, and to kind of qualify that, I wanted to kind of raise a few considerations about what we think a well-run facility would be, and what some of those kind of considerations are that contribute to those environmental benefits. The first one I wanted to note is ensuring that we have develop appropriate capacity, particularly if any of these facilities would require some sort of public subsidy to operate. Many of you are aware of other types of facilities where we've generated energy from waste, and while that is definitely preferable to disposal, there are considerations. Things like waste prevention and recycling typically do have a greater benefit to the environment, and so we want to make sure that the capacity we develop is based on a good analysis of the wastes available, so that we aren't reducing the costs of disposal to the point where we're incentivizing creating more waste. So I think that's a very important consideration as we explore where to apply these technologies in Minnesota, is just making sure that we aren't building something that we then have to feed with waste streams that we could otherwise prevent or not need to manage in the first place. A second consideration that we think is really important is just ensuring that the solids and liquids from the process are managed to their highest and best use. So in many circumstances, the solid waste coming out of the digesters can be composted, in which case the compost can be a valuable soil amendment, can be a product that can be marketed and can be used for many benefits that can protect water quality, can have some nice economic benefits as well. But in other cases, sometimes that solid needs to be that solid waste needs to be land applied, and it would not have a benefit. It kind of requires further management, and so we would advocate for policy that prioritizes things like composting with waste from anaerobic digestion and other digestion or biogas generating technologies. And then the other important thing is just the facility operations, just making sure that they are operating in accordance with regulations for managing the solid waste that comes through the facilities, with the regulations for air emissions, and with the stormwater regulations that would apply to the types of materials that they're handling on site. So if they're able to do those types of things, then the facilities can have a number of environmental benefits, but it's important that those operational practices are followed for us to realize those benefits. So with that, I'm going to turn things over to Bruce, and Bruce is going to speak a little bit more specifically about some of the air quality considerations.
Madam Chairman and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I am Bruce Brayton, and I'm going to present a perspective on air quality. From a general point of view, when compared to displaced coal combustion, biogas emissions compare favorably. In addition, biogas production and collection is a way to reduce methane gases. In a very simplistic point of view, and you're going to be going through a lot more detail on how facilities work, but you've got three basic steps in this whole process. One is your delivery of organics to your site. The second part is your vessels or your anaerobic digesters. And your third part, you may have combustion sources on site or not. If your facility only consists of the delivery and conveying of organics and the actual vessels, the emissions from those sources are very minimal. When you have the combustion sources on site, most emissions are coming from the combustion sources. And so we just want to make that distinction up front. If you have combustion on site, it is most likely that you will be triggered into some type of permit action from the agency. The way our permits work is it's on a continuum of emissions. The greater your emissions are, the more programs that may apply to you. So what we've seen is most proposals we have seen will trigger some type of agency permit action. Within our programs, we've got two sets of performance standards that would apply to engines. One is a federal performance standard for engines, and there's also a state performance standard for engines. Air quality concerns that we have seen so far is, as part of the anaerobic digestion process, hydrogen sulfide is a trace gas that can be produced through the digestion system. If you have a good design and good operation, it should be minimized, but that is always a concern with these type of facilities. Also, when you have engines in the past, what we've seen is a lot of times the engine has a real low stack for emissions, and you've had bad dispersion, and so you've had some nitrogen oxide issues. As long as the stacks are high, you've got good dispersion. That shouldn't be an issue, but that has been an issue. And then in terms of air emission permit applications, we must have sufficient information to accurately quantify the emissions as part of the pre-construction process. One of the issues that we're having with right now with all new technologies is sometimes there's a limited amount of emission factor information out there, and so we're kind of in a catch-22 where we want you to quantify the project up front before we issue the permit, but there might be limited information on what the actual emissions will be coming out of the facility. So for next steps?
Yeah, so just in closing, a couple of things that we wanted to note. The agency is committed to working with facility proposals to ensure that environmental considerations are addressed, particularly with respect to the siting, the operating practices, and the facility design. So we have worked with this number of facilities to help get them permitted. We understand the importance of making the permitting process as simple as possible despite the complex nature of these projects. So we do bring in staff from different disciplines, the solid waste, water, air, to make that process as painless as possible for project proposers. And then given the fact that the second point I wanted to close with was given the fact that this is an emerging technology, we're very committed to paying attention to the scientific literature on the benefits and potential risks of using this technology. I know, for example, our colleagues at the Department of Environmental Quality in Oregon are currently conducting a life cycle analysis of the different biogas technologies, as well as comparing that to other waste management activities like composting, waste prevention, recycling, those types of things. And those types of things we think will be important for us to continue to track so that we can participate in ensuring that our state's able to have an informed conversation about where this best fits in and how we want to proceed with creating opportunities to capture biogas in Minnesota.
Questions from members? Representative Wiginius.
And not so much a question, but an observation. You said you're going to be working with facility proposers and are welcoming that, and that's great. But I wonder if this is a time to go beyond that. The legislature in the last session put more money into SCORE for composting in the metro area at the request of the metro folks. So they are interested in going forward with composting. So since we are going composting in the metro, and that seems to be something that's on the up, why wouldn't you be more aggressive and work with them to look at this as the second opportunity as they're doing composting? Because I have not heard so much about, I mean, they were just talking about composting as far as I know, as, you know, a source and to get it out of the garbage stream. But if there's this additional benefit, why isn't the agency helping out to frame the question and help them move forward?
Yes, so thank you for the question. We absolutely are very interested in seeing more capture of organic material from the waste stream, and we are making a number of proactive efforts to make that happen. Currently, we do have a number of source-separated organics composting facilities in the state. We are working on revising the regulations for those facilities to reduce barriers and allow development of additional facilities. Just as the previous speaker noted, there are some pretty noteworthy economic considerations with terms in respect to anaerobic digestion and some of these technologies. The facilities might cost $25 or $30 million to get established. So we simply don't have those facilities currently available to manage the organic waste. And as such, I would say we've prioritized the traditional composting, the windrow composting, and invent vessel composting, since we see that there's a real immediate opportunities on that end. We're also really committed to working with local governments and private waste haulers to provide more opportunities for residents and businesses to recycle their organic waste through composting. And I certainly think this could be something that fits into that. It's just something that's maybe at its earlier stages. And to my knowledge, the agency has not you know, provided grant funds or things of that nature to establish anaerobic digestion technology. However, we have done that to support traditional composting since we're a little further along there.
Representative Guineas.
But if we put too much of our effort into just traditional composting, then it's going to be harder to switch. So could we be thinking about how Sweden did it and be borrowing more of their creative thinking so that we don't get stuck in the old technology?
I think the two processes can be very complementary, certainly we need to be mindful of that in how we develop things, and I think that the approach we're taking to promote composting would allow for that, where the source of organics could be managed through anaerobic digestion and then composted. So I certainly think we're very much leaving the door open for that.
Senator Senjum.
Thank you, and thank you to the testifiers again. I just want to either confirm or maybe dispel some coffee shop talk. You know, we all get that. And perhaps you don't know the answer, but is getting a digester permit in Minnesota, an agricultural type permit, any more difficult in Wisconsin or Iowa, or is it easier there, or you think, generally speaking, their laws or our laws, et cetera? We tend to hear that it's far easier to move things like this forward in my area, in particular Iowa, I hear about. But
Madam Chairman and committee members, we hear that comment also. The air permit process is the most complicated of all the processes. We're based and modeled after the federal program. And so if it's federally based, it should be consistent between states.
Yeah.
We've seen a few instances where South Dakota works with Region 9 EPA. We work with Region 5, and there's some disparities between how they look at things. We talked to Region 5 about that on several issues. But there shouldn't be a whole lot of difference.
Okay.
It's driven by the federal.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Any other questions from members? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think we're back on schedule. Next, we're going to hear from the Metropolitan Council, which I understand is already doing some really interesting work in this area.
Thank you. I'm Carol Mordorsky. I'm a principal engineer with Metropolitan Council. Metropolitan Council is the regional agency that owns and operates the wastewater treatment plants. We have 8 plants. We have 600 miles of interceptor sewers that take waste from the edges of the community into our plants. We serve 108 communities. That's increased in the last few years from, you know, about 105 just a few years ago. We have the capacity to treat 372 million gallons per day of wastewater. We're currently treating about 250 million gallons. Our plants have, you know, excellent compliance records, and we have rates that are very competitive for metropolitan areas of our comparable size. So several years ago, we had an energy goal. In 2006, we decided that we were going to reduce the amount of purchased energy for all of our systems by 10%. And we accomplished that by the goal year of 2010. So then we identified another goal to further reduce purchased energy, measuring it in overall million BTUs, by 15% from the base year of 2006. And we're on our way to doing that. We're hoping to do that by 2015. Beyond that, we have a goal of reducing purchased energy by 2020 from 50% from the base year. So how are we going to do that? Part of it is by use of biogas. these are the four major ways that Amanda talked about some of these, that wastewater treatment plants can use biogas from anaerobic digestion. One of them is a microturbine, which generates electricity. And there's also a combined heat and power system where you take the biogas, you run it through a boiler, and you generate heat for a building, or you run it through an engine generator and you generate power. At Blue Lake, we have a rotary drum dryer. We're going to talk more about how we took that from running on purchased natural gas to running completely on biogas. Or you can, if you can clean the you can clean the biogas up enough, you can use it to run natural gas vehicles. Now, I talked about, you know, there's pros and cons for these different systems. One of the issues is that biogas is a very dirty fuel, and so you have to use certain processes to remove the contaminants in it in order to make sure that it doesn't it isn't hard on the equipment that it runs on. So our Empire plant, which is an Empire Township down by Lakeville, south of the Twin Cities, currently they use the biogas to preheat the sludge because there are different kinds of anaerobic digestion. The kind we use mesophilic microbes, and those operate at about the same temperature that our bodies operate, about 98 degrees Fahrenheit. And so one of the things you want to do with digestion is you want your system to be, you want it to be autogenic. You want to make sure that you aren't having to add energy to the system to get your microbes up to 98 degrees Fahrenheit. Most wastewater is at about 50 to 60 degrees Fahrenheit. So first of all, you take that biogas and you preheat the sludge so that your digesters are not needing additional heat to run. And then if you have excess biogas, which you usually do, you know, we use it to heat the buildings. So one of the things that's happening is we're kind of at the end of a cycle for some of the equipment we were using at Empire, and we're going to change so that we're instead having a combined heat and power system. What we're finding is, you know, the electricity rates are a little higher than the natural gas rates at this point, and so what we're going to do is put in an engine generator. We're going to continue to preheat the sludge, but then we're going to generate energy so that we supply about one-third of the power demand at the plant. So one of the things we are going to do at Empire is add some treatment systems so that we pre-treat that gas and remove some of the moisture and sulfide contaminants, and then run it through our new engine generator to generate power. We anticipate about $350,000 $350,000 a year of savings in electrical costs. And we would be recovering about 21,000 million BTUs a year. So the project that I've been most involved in, and we began planning in 2003, we began design in 2006, did the project in 2009, is to build anaerobic digestions at our Blue Lake wastewater treatment plant. The Blue Lake plant serves the Shakopee, Lake Minnetonka area, Prior Lake area. It treats an average of 32 million gallons of wastewater a year and discharges to the Minnesota River. And serves about a population of about 300,000 people. That square area is the new digester complex. So before we put in digesters, what we would do is we took our biosolids at the plant and we dried them in a rotary drum dryer. And we would generate a fertilizer product that we call Minigro. Our partner, NEFCO, operates the plant for us and markets the pellets. And until 2012, we were operating that rotary drum dryer purely on purchased natural gas. So the dryer was beginning to experience more outages, and so we were at a point where we could either build another dryer or instead, because we had these energy-wide agency-wide energy goals, We felt that a better option was putting in anaerobic digesters. So another issue we had that the digesters would help on that another dryer would not is that if the dryer was out of service, we would have to hold solids in the liquid systems, and that's really not the way you want to operate. You want to continuously be removing all the solids from the different clarifier steps and from the activated sludge process. You don't want to be building solids up. And so the digester provides kind of a wide spot in the line so that we could run the dryer, we could take the dryer out of service and still be feeding those digesters. By putting in the digesters, we also reduce loading to the dryer by about 30%, and we've realized that wastewater treatment generates about 1 dry ton per day per million gallons treated. And so before we put in the digesters, we had about 33 dry tons per day that we were generating. Now we're down to about 22. So we saw exactly that 30% solids reduction. The other advantage of digestion is that, you know, it produces the biogas that we wanted to use to fuel the dryer. So we built and we started our digesters up. But as it's been mentioned before, anaerobic microbes are very fussy. They demand that you keep the temperature at 98 degrees and that you don't vary that more than 1 or 2 degrees. You can upset your process. That's one of the issues with operating digesters. It's very critical. The microbes, because they grow slowly, it took a lot more time to establish the process than we expected. We had about 5 months until we were really fully producing gas, but then there's all these different pieces of equipment that we use to clean the gas and pressurize the gas, and getting all those different pieces of equipment to coordinate well was difficult. So we had talked to CenterPoint about a rebate. They usually didn't give rebates for non-pipeline quality, but we said, well, we are using all the gas on site, and we're still, you know, abating a great deal of natural gas. And so, you know, if we had built another dryer, we'd be increasing the amount of purchased natural gas. And so they wanted a six-month demonstration that we were really utilizing that gas and really seeing the drop in purchased natural gas that we hope to see. So this shows, there are two graphs. One is during the startup, and it shows the biogas production is the dashed line on the top, and the biogas utilization is the blue line, solid line, and then the amount flared is the red line. So you can see we got to the point where we were utilizing all the gas in the dryer. On the right side, that shows operation just a couple weeks ago, and you can see that we're utilizing the gas except for the time when we had a few days where we take the dryer out of service for maintenance. And so that little drop in gas utilization is just when the dryer was out of service. We're even to the point where now we're starting to flare some gas, and so we have plans for that gas too. Now, as I mentioned before, biogas generated by anaerobic digestion of wastewater contains a lot of moisture, dirt, sulfides. And so we have equipment to do this, to reduce these contaminants so that it doesn't corrode our equipment. We have something called a foam separator where you just spray water. We use effluent water to do this through to remove the particles. And then we have a refrigerant dryer, which is like a dehydrator, and that condenses all the moisture out of the gas. We also have a membrane cover, and that keeps a greater amount of gas in the system so that we can consistently feed that gas to the dryer and not have any lapses in supplying the gas. So we have completely or virtually eliminated purchased natural gas for running the dryer at annual savings of about $500,000. That's the equivalent of gas that would fuel, say, about 900 households. We've reduced our pellet production. And that, by the same token, reduces the amount of fossil fuels that we need to haul those pellets, you know, out to farm fields. So CenterPoint required that we document the before and after natural gas use, and we did that, and we earned a $150,000 rebate from CenterPoint. So now we want to use our knowledge of using biogas to on another program. We have a proposed program to work with some of the industries that discharge to our system. We're concerned that some of our plants, again, have solids capacity issue, and as industries start to increase their loading, they start to use up more of the plant capacity. So some of the industries have come to us, and we feel that it merits looking at putting together a program where the industries would build systems to pre-treat the waste. And it could be anaerobic digestion, it could be some other kind of system. The council would initially own, and we would provide the financing for those systems, but then the industry would lease the system from us at a discounted rate. And the discount would depend on, you know, how much waste reduction they're proposing and their rates and things like that. We have a very elaborate program that we've put together on how this would work. And then as we see the waste reduction, they would realize this discounted payment to us for running their pretreatment system. And if it was digestion, then the industry would be able to use that energy on site. So some of the costs and benefits of this proposed program is that we would lose the revenue for, you know, treating their waste, but we would gain capacity at the plants, and we would reduce the operating costs associated with having that reduced loading, and we would hope that there would be rebates associated with maybe using the biogas or, you know, the equipment. For the industries, they would reduce their payments to us, and they would reduce their associated operating cost. They would have a lease payment to us, and then it would be like a lease to buy system. If they operate the system for 10 years, then they would own the system. That would be our terms. We have some clauses for if they defaulted on that. We have ways to evaluate their financial solvency for participating in the program. And we would also evaluate the technology they would propose. So we feel like this would be a win-win-win program. Right now it's proposed. It still has to be approved by our council.
Could I ask a question about that? So what would the form be of the product you're selling, compressed natural gas?
Well, it would depend. You know, if the industry wanted to use the biogas to generate power at their site, they could do that. So they could go, I would guess that they would probably not clean it up all the way to pipeline quality. They would probably use it on site for electricity, maybe for just hot water, depending on what their process was. So,
thank you.
A lot of possibilities. They might not even do anaerobic digestion. They might do some other kind of pretreatment system. One of them has talked about reverse osmosis.
Thank you. Other questions from members? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to jump on the last slide. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you so much for the presentation. It's a great presentation. Sounds like you're doing some exciting things. A couple of things that I heard that I didn't hear in the previous presentations was about a corrosion risk. And that's something I'm inquiring about. Is that just because that there are more other ingredients and other items in the natural in this particular biomass gas, or?
Well, decomposition of organic feedstocks generally results in some kind of sulfides. For wastewater treatment, it's probably somewhat more because, you know, if wastewater stays in the system, in the pipeline, you know, it'll generate sulfides, and so then you have sulfides in the sludge. But, you know, you'd have the same issue with manure. You know, whenever you have something that you have to store for a certain amount of time, it starts to decompose and you have sulfides to deal with. And almost any stock is going to have particles and dirt and things like that. And then if it's anaerobic digestion of a liquid, obviously, you know, the biogas is going to have moisture in it. And so, you know, moisture corrodes engines.
Sure. All right. Thank you. And a follow-up question? The other question that I just had was, it sounds like in most of your processes here, everything is that is generated is also used on site. Is that correct?
Are you talking about the sludge or are you talking about the biogas?
Biogas. Sorry.
Yes, the biogas is used on site. We would have to put in some pretty expensive equipment to get to pipeline quality.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Russo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I was just going to comment on that, that, you know, the difference between your facility and a facility that is dedicated to the production of biogas is that in the there's an economy of scale in which you would put in that sort of equipment to refine it if your goal was to produce saleable biogas. But in this situation, since you're using it on site, the economics aren't the same for that.
The dryer is particularly forgiving of the gas quality because the gas is just burned up in the dryer. So it's probably the best application, but it's an unusual one. Not everybody has pelletizing. Anybody that knows about milorganite, that is a pelletized product, and, you know, they do have, you know, I think they have digesters at a different location.
Representative Wiginias.
Thank you. Good to hear about some of the things you're doing at Empire and Blue Lake.
Yeah.
Do your other facilities have
anaerobic digesters?
Mm-hmm.
No, they don't. A lot of our plants are very small, aside from the Metro plant, and mm-hmm. so the smaller plants, they will concentrate their waste in like a settling tank, and then they'll haul it to the Metro plant. And at the Metro plant and at the Seneca plant, we incinerate our waste. We have some very elaborate heat recovery systems at the Metro plant, too. I think we generate, Sarah might be able to help me, something like 6 megawatts of electricity at the Metro plant. We have a steam system. We take the waste heat from the incinerator and we generate steam, and we have steam heat for a numerous chain of buildings and tunnels, service tunnels at the Metro plant. At the Seneca plant, we have a heat recovery system again for the hot water, and we heat, we had about a $90,000 a year reduction in our energy bills by recovering heat from the waste heat from that incinerator. So like I said, we're expecting that we will achieve the 25% goal by 2015, and we've done that by not just the biogas systems, but numerous energy reduction systems throughout our systems. So energy is a big deal.
Can I? Representative Wiginias.
I appreciate what you're doing. Have you all started to think about your next goal out?
Well, that's the 50% by 2020.
Okay, it's energy reduction.
Overall purchased energy, yes. And so, yeah, that would be, that's going to be big. I'm not sure exactly what some of the plans are for that, but we have energy systems all over. Whenever we update motors, we require premium efficiency motors on all of the motors for the equipment of the system.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually at Blue Lake, as we get more and more gas, one of the things I think I kind of skipped over is that we will be, when the dryer's out of service, we have to use hot water to create the sludge, and we want to use biogas. We've had some problems with controls coordination between the boiler and the biogas system. So once we straighten that out, we'll not only be able to preheat the sludge, but we'll also heat the building. It's a 20,000-square-foot building using the biogas.
Representative Wiginias.
In one of our budgets, we gave some clean water money to Pollution Control Agency to work with the Civil Engineering Department at the U for wastewater to keep refining and getting better, and that was a collaboration. Do they also work with you? I'm just thinking of sharing knowledge right now.
We have our own R&D department, but yes, we work with the youth somewhat, and we go to professional conferences. All of our plants for years have had both nitrogen and phosphorus removal. All of our plants remove phosphorus to less than one part per million. This is the liquid side now I'm talking about, not the solid side. And we also remove ammonia nitrogen to varying degrees. At Blue Lake, we're less than two parts in the summer. At the Metro plant, I guess they're less than one part. What we found is that we just run the plant. It's easier to run the plant to just keep it at virtually nothing, no nitrogen discharge year-round, rather than varying the operation. But this is getting away from biogas.
Okay. Representative McGinnis.
What I'm after here is figuring out how best to share knowledge across the state. And one of the ways we tried to help with that was to give money to the Pollution Control Agency to actually, I wouldn't say hire, but work with the civil engineering department at the U, which is just outstanding. Mm-hmm. And it does seem like a bit more collaboration, so we can all be sharing this, and that might be the route, and that's what I'm asking about.
Yeah. One of the things CenterPoint required of us for our rebate is that we collaborate with anybody they were working with that wanted to start up digesters, that we share our knowledge and our experience, and we're more than, you know, delighted to do that.
I think maybe some other conversations with the Pollution Control Agency would be helpful here. I mean, sharing is good.
Any other questions from members? I think we'll move on then to the next presentation. Mr. Mark from CenterPoint. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Nick Mark from CenterPoint Energy. I manage conservation and renewable energy policy. And biogas kind of touches on both of those fields, which is why I'm here now. In a nutshell, what I have to say is, you know, the three-minute version of this, or half-minute, if you like, is that we've made some very initial forays into the world of biogas, and it's an interesting topic for us. There are some real challenges with it, but we're interested in working with others to try to figure out what ideas can move forward and have potential to help move the ball forward with biogas and renewable natural gas in general, trying to figure out what can work for all parties. So far, our involvement has involved the Conservation Improvement Program. We've been involved in two biogas projects in Minnesota, one at a food processor and the other at the Blue Lake wastewater plant that we just heard about. In both of those, we were able to provide a SIP rebate, basically because the gas that was involved was being both produced and used on site. Therefore, you've got a situation where you're reducing the need for utility gas to come into the system. So the customer both had a waste stream and a need for heat that they had been meeting with natural gas. Because they were able to basically reduce their use of utility natural gas through biogas, they're able to continue the same level of economic output from their facility with less overall input to the facility, which is basically the definition of efficiency. So SIP worked really well for that. SIP doesn't work as well for projects where you don't have a use for the gas on the site, where you need to move it off site, especially for cleaning it up. In order to move it off site, you need either a dedicated pipeline so that if it's a lower quality biogas, that you can't commingle with utility gas, you need a dedicated pipe, and so you're going to want somebody who can use it pretty close by. Getting it to pipeline quality and putting it back into the utility system means it has to be climbed to a fairly high degree of quality, which is expensive. There's a lot of capital involved in getting it to that level. And that tends to make it not cost-effective according to the tests that we use in SIP. In addition, when you're producing energy and exporting it from the facility, that doesn't really fit with the demand-side focus of SIP that we've traditionally looked at, where you're trying to figure to reduce the overall energy use of that facility. So SIP isn't a great fit for high-quality renewable natural gas or biomethane. As I said, getting it to that level of quality is challenging for producers because it's expensive. And what that means is that those producers tend to be looking for a higher economic return than we're able to provide given the current commodity cost of natural gas. As we heard, you're looking at production costs ranging from $10 to $15 per MMBTU, with natural gas costs closer to $4 or $5. It just doesn't make sense. So they have to find some way of obtaining a premium in order to make their projects cash flow. Typically, that can be the vehicle fuels market that we heard about earlier with the renewable fuel standard, or sometimes electric generation, typically outside of Minnesota, is where you'll find those premium markets for biogas generation. But anyone else who wants the gas is going to be competing with those projects because, again, those producers need to be able to get that premium to make their projects cash flow. So from a utility standpoint, given that level of premium and the comparison to the commodity cost, for us to simply buy the gas that's produced as system gas just doesn't meet the prudency test. So going forward, the more likely role for the utility that we've been able to identify is to try to figure out how to help producers get their high-quality gas into a premium market so that they can make the deal work. We've done some preliminary exploration of this idea, but we don't have anything sort of solid or ready to go right now. In addition, the ideas that we have come up with are not simple to implement. There are a lot of reasons for that, and these are just some examples. From a regulatory standpoint, we need to understand exactly what the rules are. If you're trying to move gas through our system back onto an interstate pipeline, you may have FERC involved or other regulatory aspects as well. From an operational standpoint, if the producer is sort of at the edges of our distribution system, the system may not have the capacity to take the gas that they're producing, either on an ordinary basis, or there may simply be times or times of year or times of day when they're producing more than we can absorb on the system at that point. This is very similar to the kinds of challenges that we've seen with wind development, for example, on the electric side, where the infrastructure just isn't there where the resource is. In addition, you know, just from the way people are used to thinking about the business, this is a significant change to be putting gas in at the edges rather than bringing it up to the edges. So it really sort of changes the way you think about the utility business, not just for us, but for our regulators and other stakeholders. So where we go from here, we're looking for ideas. We're interested in trying to find things that can help producers make their projects work, that benefit our customers, and that make business sense for us as a utility. So we're interested in partnering with whoever can help us figure out what those ideas are, frankly. Some of the things we've thought about include the idea of a green gas retail offering that would be an option for customers to pay more on their bill, similar to a wind source sort of product, or possibly a specific tariff that would help us, you know, work with a producer to sort of build some of the infrastructure that might be needed to bring their product to market. The one thing I'll sort of leave you with is, given that what we're seeing right now suggests that, you know, the primary market driving renewable natural gas is the transportation fuel market, it may be that we want to, in order to promote the production, the best way to do that would be to ensure that there is that vehicle fuels market, that is to say, vehicles who can use it as a fuel. And so encouraging the adoption of natural gas vehicles may be one way forward with that. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that I can.
Thank you. My first question is, have you been to Sweden? And are they having any better luck there getting it clean and using it in other applications? I know Ms. Billick talked about this a little bit. But I was trying not to make weird faces at the time. So do you know, are they further along in the processing end of it to get it clean?
Madam Chair, I have not been to Sweden. I don't know the answer to that. I might defer to Ms. Billick on some of that. My understanding, though, is that the technologies that are involved are similar, and that it's more an issue of does it make sense from an economic standpoint, given the cost of gas or the policy options that have been employed.
And my guess is internationally the natural gas prices are a whole different beast.
Europe is a completely different market, yes. Okay.
Other questions from members? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next.
Putin has a little bit to do with that.
A little bit?
Mr. Klein, who's doing all renewable energy all the time, it seems like. But I'm sure you do other things there at the St. Paul Port Authority. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Good morning. So today I'd like to just briefly talk about some of the Port Authority projects that we are operating and then talk specifically about 9 specific anaerobic digester projects that we've been involved in. So first of all, we have 4 different areas that we are working in, Trillium BTU, PACE, Energy Savings Partnership, and anaerobic digestion. About 5 years ago, the legislature granted us $5 million of ARRA funds to create a revolving loan fund for commercial and industrial businesses. We've done over 70 projects, $30 million. We're halfway to our trillion, so 500 billion BTU saved cumulatively, created or retained 1,000 jobs, and have not lost $1. So pretty good investment by the state, and in fact, Commerce describes it as their best program, Department of Commerce. PACE, Department of Commerce, because of our success with Trillium BTU, they asked us to try to figure out how to get PACE, Property Assessed Clean Energy, moving in the state of Minnesota. We now have a couple dozen joint powers agreements. We're doing projects from a student housing project in Mankato to the Miller Hill Mall in Duluth. Quite a few solar projects, and anticipate renewable energy projects and solar particularly, and multi-tenant buildings has been a niche that PACE can offer a solution to finance projects throughout the state. And then the Energy Savings Partnership is for local units of government, school districts, counties, cities, usually on the smaller side. As the Department of Commerce is guaranteed energy savings program is just getting kicked off, we anticipate a lot more projects coming, but we have done school district, the city, and the Southwest Transit Authority project. So we do have a few under our belt on that one. But again, as GASP starts taking off, we'll do more. So specifically related to the anaerobic digestion projects, we do have one project that was completed, and that's Liberty Paper. So that is the treatment of the short paper fiber. And I guess to show where the economics were beneficial for them is that they really saved a significant amount of money in wastewater treatment charges. And in fact, the local Becker wastewater treatment plant was not able to fully treat all of the effluent from the Becker plant. In fact, they were trucking a substantial amount to the Metro plant here in St. Paul. So that was where the economics made that project really worthwhile. Even with that, it was probably a 7-8 year payback, but it allowed them to expand. It allowed the Becker wastewater treatment plant to take on additional effluent. So it was a really good solution for that project. Other projects that we see that really felt confident that they are going to go forward in 2015 are the Sanimax project. So that's a rendering facility in South St. Paul. And they're the largest hauler of organic waste for companies like Walmart. And that project has a site. It has the permit from the city to be constructed. They're just looking for additional material and supply of material. It's about 150,000 tons a year that project would treat. And right now they're looking to build the committed feedstocks up to about 100,000 tons per year. That the use of that energy is primarily going to be used to fuel their fleet, and the RIN credit is the reason for that. Another project that we feel that can go forward within the next year is the Randy Sanitation Project. Similar, Randy Sanitation has been separating or collecting separated organics for over 8 years. They would create a digester with some new technology, and they definitely are looking at the San Jose and San Francisco projects to create their program. And again, they would fuel their vehicles with the biogas primarily. And then the digestate that comes out of the digester would continue to go to the composting facilities. And it's really a different, they delineate that waste stream a little differently in that a lot of the clean organic waste still can go to the composters, but the not so clean organic waste is going to go through their system, but then the end result after the energy is captured would still go to the composters. And then Michael Foods is a potato processing facility in Chaska. They would benefit and really offset their natural gas use. So they would just blend the biogas in with their natural gas use, and the percentage there would be, they would not have to do a significant change to their facility, maybe a burner kit that would change a little bit, because the percentage of the biogas to the natural gas use would not be that great. So that one definitely has good economics. We've got 9 projects here. We've looked at many others, and what we found was if there wasn't any additional transport and you could use all the energy on site, those were the best economic conditions. But even with those, you needed some additional economic benefit, and you, generally speaking, that's a reduction in wastewater treatment charges. Then other projects that have the potential of going forward in 2015 or maybe a little bit longer are the Rembrandt Farms project in Renville, and that's an egg laying facility. There's also the Southern Minnesota Beets Association that is potential feedstock, and there are some dairy and other operations, agricultural operations down there that could utilize the could send their feedstock to this facility. Then the city of Austin is connected directly with the Hormel packing plant, and there are issues they need to expand. They do have digesters on site right now that are operating because of this program. They have expanded the use of the digesters, and there's probably additional energy that can be captured through digestion at those facilities somewhere between the Hormel plant and the City of Austin wastewater treatment plant. American Crystal Sugar is a facility that I think under the 1603 grant made economic sense. Unfortunately, they were going through a strike at the time, and so the engineers weren't able to pay attention to the digester project, but that one is not as attractive as the others because the energy produced at that site would be, the majority of the energy would be after the plant is shut down. So in that situation, you're either going to have to create electricity that would be put on the grid or clean the biogas up to natural gas pipeline quality, though both of those create a negative economic scenario for the economic viability of the project. Then we've worked with Met Council, and their IPIP suggestion, I think, is going to be a national model. I think that that is truly, it's similar to SIP. It's the reduction of the public, the need for public investment in infrastructure. And we feel that that is going to be a national model when it is implemented. And then Rock 10, which is really the base for the St. Paul Port Authority to really get involved in these anaerobic digestion projects. They can do a similar project to the Liberty Paper. Right now, it doesn't make economic sense, but under the IPIP program, I believe it will make economic sense. They pay the most wastewater treatment charge of any industry in the metro area. So those are the nine projects. Again, we looked at and looked at ethanol plants. Technically, it worked great. You can produce a lot of energy off of the dried distiller grains, but economically, they're just worth more as feed than it is for energy at this point. So we don't think that those situations, the ethanol plants, would work under today's economics. And we looked at canning operations. Again, it's just such a short period of time, and they're not going to be able to utilize the energy on site. So those projects have less economic advantage. These nine projects we do think have economic viability. So to get some of these going, and again, the economics show that they're probably in the under the, where natural gas is and the cost of these projects, they're probably in the 8 to 10 year payback period. And generally, that's just not a good enough payback for the investors. So one idea that we've proposed is the creation of a $20 million investment fund of patient capital. It'd be similar to a trillion BTU, that there would be $20 million. That would create $80 million or leverage $80 million of private funds and create at least four or five of these projects would actually go forward, we believe. And if we did have four or five of these go forward, we think there would be about a trillion BTUs of renewable energy annually, expand the current wastewater treatment capacity of wastewater treatment plants while reducing their energy, create about 1,000 construction jobs. Again, the digesters do not require a significant amount of manpower to operate, so a couple of full-time equivalents per digester. That would generate $7 million of new revenue to the state through the sales tax and the payroll tax, and the $20 million investment would be payback in 5 years to the state. So it's similar to a revolving loan fund, just with patient capital not being serviced on a monthly basis, but being repaid in 5 years. And with that cash flow, that's about a 25% return on the investment to the state of Minnesota. And go back to those specific projects, and any questions I can answer.
Thank you. Questions for members? I have a couple questions. I'm curious why we're not seeing a lot of animal waste proposals in this category. I guess I thought in Minnesota that was kind of the primary area where anaerobic digestion had been used in the past, and maybe where it had future application, because it's kind of a double win where you get the energy and then you also maybe solve a clean water issue. And I was wondering, in your position of financing projects like this, are animal waste projects being brought to you, or are these kind of food waste projects just technically superior or more cost effective, or why aren't we seeing animal waste proposals?
Two reasons that we did not look at those. One is because of animal waste, they've already been through a digester, and so the amount of energy available is not as great as these projects. In addition, they're going to be smaller in size, so we were looking at large-scale projects that could produce a lot. if you had a large-scale project and one was being constructed in Iowa in Sioux, I can't remember
the name.
Sioux what?
Sioux City?
Sioux City, I think it was. Anyhow, just over the border from Minnesota. And that facility was actually constructed but never got under operation. And I believe that one of the problems was it was taking animal waste from not too much of an area, 15-mile radius. They had a lot of feedlots. But that additional transport and cost, and then the actual energy that was able to be generated from those is just not that great. Certainly on a large-scale dairy farm, there are, or any feedlot, I guess, there is potential. We just weren't looking at those because it wasn't the significant projects that we were felt that we could produce a significant amount of biogas from.
Questions from members? Well, thank you very much for the presentation. I think your performance on the Trillion BTU project makes us really look carefully at the proposal you have, and we'll definitely be talking about that as we get ready for the next session.
Thank you.
Our final presenter, Dr. Patrick Hurl from Burns and McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
And we're ahead of schedule, so I think that we should be able to wrap things up by 11:15.
Yeah, after all the people that have come before me, I get to kind of take a lot of my technical background's already been put out there, which is good that this stage is set. And especially Peter Klein, just going a number of the studies that he's talked about, I've had the honor of being able to run those for him and look through them. What I'd like to then talk about is my experience in trying to develop the types of projects that Peter was just talking about, and specifically, as I've titled this, looking at what are the roadblocks of why my clients haven't gone forward with them, and with each one of those kind of sections, talking about what are some of the ways that we could try to overcome those roadblocks, and some of them Peter's put out already and some other ones I want to put out there. Just a little bit, Burns and McDonald, we're a full-service engineering and design and construction company. We're kind of I'll call ourselves mid-size. We're about 4,500 employee owners nationwide. Headquartered out of Kansas City, we have an 80-person office here in Bloomington, which is where I office out of. Myself, I've been in the I'll call it the anaerobic business for about 28 years. My doctoral dissertation was in anaerobic technology. I've spent probably the last 10 years looking at not only the design and implementation of anaerobic technologies, but spending a lot of time in the last 5 years looking at the finances of how do you take these projects and be able to apply them. I've worked in the bioremediation, the wastewater treatment, both industrial and municipal, as well as, like I said, really in the last 5 years, spending a lot of time over in the energy area. I've got two patents in integration of biogas into corn ethanol. I've developed processes for working directly with Southern California Gas Company and looking at lots of different ways to generate renewable natural gas, not just anaerobic digestion, as we're talking about today. And we were talking about earlier about, from CenterPoint, Nick, you were talking about putting gas into the pipeline for 18 months. I've operated a facility to actually do that in the state of California. So very familiar with those technologies and actually how to run them and how to make pipeline quality gas. But just to kind of use a diagram here, we've been talking about one of the things that Peter had just mentioned. I do tend to focus on larger facilities and what I'll call higher energy feedstocks. Peter did a good job of talking about why manure is a lower energy feedstock. There's a lot of, Madam Chairman, you'd ask that question about, it's both energy production as well as environmental, and what you tend to find is that the energy production has a value to it and the environmental has attributes to it, but trying to put hard numbers and money to that to make a project go becomes very difficult. And so when you begin to look at these, you start shifting over and talking about how do I make energy production facilities, and that's really what I'm talking about. So you know, we've talked about industrial co-products here, things like using concentrated industrial wastes. We've talked a little bit about source-separated organics as another feedstock that might be out there. We've talked about the technologies in the middle there, anaerobic digesters, and we've also talked some about how that biogas can flow out into power generation or get upgraded, and there are some of those markets. We've talked specifically about CNG, compressed natural gas, as a higher value marketplace. And so what I'd like to do is talk about roadblocks on the feedstock end, roadblocks on the energy, or we'll call it the energy, low cost, or you know, a lot of people look at their bill when it comes and we say we don't have cheap energy. Well, our energy is fairly low cost and worldwide, and we do benefit from that here in the Midwest. Then we're going to talk about some. We've talked a lot about technologies, but from a financing standpoint, I want to talk some about what are some of those roadblocks in the implementation of technologies in these. Energy production space. So when we talk about feedstocks, specifically when we talk about source-separated organics, okay, so these are coming from restaurants or cafeteria facilities or even from individual residences, they tend to be distributed over a large area, like we can talk about what we could collect from individual homes across the metro area here. They are low energy density, means that they carry a lot of water along with them because our food is typically something in the area of maybe 50 to 70% water, and the water doesn't make any of our energy. They're not currently aggregated, at least separately. They come with our garbage, and they can end up in wherever all of that garbage ends up and needs to get then separated out. They do degrade rapidly. The feedstocks that we're interested in, ones that can produce a lot of biogas, are highly biodegradable, which means if I let them sit and let them get warm on a nice hot day, they will begin to rot very quickly. That's the same process that we want to do inside the tank in order to be able to generate biogas. And these can be going to landfills or to incineration units. And therefore, there is a value to somebody out there already in the marketplace. That is, that landfill or the incineration, you know, whoever's doing the ultimate disposal is getting revenue from that. So it's just because we see it as waste, somebody's making money on it already, and therefore it has a value to somebody. And just to try to take it off the market, that individual or that company that's generating revenue on it is going to be concerned about that. And therefore, there's a value. We'll talk a little bit about that here in a second. On the industrial co-product side, things like we've already mentioned, the stillage that comes out of, say, corn ethanol plants here in the state of Minnesota, that goes into the animal feed market. It has a very high content of being able to make biogas. It's a great biogas feedstock, but it also is a very inexpensive from the feed side when compared to today's corn prices. So it has a value, and when we talk about tipping fees on organics, when you start talking about these what we'll call really high energy feedstocks, some of them actually you have to pay to get a hold of, which even affects the economics on these projects even more. So if we look at solutions to the feedstock side of this, things like mandatory landfill organic diversion is something that can directly impact the economics of these projects, because all of a sudden what was going to a landfill and the landfill would be getting a tipping fee from that now can no longer go there, and it needs to find a disposal somewhere else, and therefore that tipping fee can now follow along with it without being degraded from or in competition with the landfill that's already out there. Tipping fee subsidies are things that I know Hennepin County has talked about as well, trying to make these things work. Sponsor collection programs, in terms of that gets to the aggregation part of trying to take that source-separated organics and get them in. Again, looking at just that organics in the waste part, I focus on that because it's a waste product that you can get paid to take and dispose of. I really didn't look at feedstock solutions on the, we'll call it the industrial co-product side, because there are markets out there in the ag industry that put a high value on those. There's really not much we can do about that because they're essential to creating lower cost feeds that allow the animal husbandry market to take advantage of those. We talk about cheap energy or low cost energy roadblocks. I was disappointed the commissioner had just left because he was asking all the money questions earlier. When we look at natural gas over the last couple of years in a $3.50 to $4 on a wholesale basis, and electricity here in the Midwest at a wholesale of maybe 3 cents a kilowatt hour, and retail something in the 7 cents a kilowatt hour, based on the Energy Agency's published data from 2013, what we see is that 8 new anaerobic digestion facilities are going to need biogas numbers in the $10 to $15 a million BTU range. So the idea that I could design, build, and operate an AD facility solely on offsetting natural gas just doesn't work. Peter had made a number of comments about that you have to look for higher value markets in order to be able to make that biogas worthwhile. And some of those, we've talked a little bit about going into the transportation market, and when you begin to talk about the renewable identification numbers or those renewable fuel credits that come out of the federal RFS2 program, what you're looking at is something that, at least in the last, we'll call it in the last month, has been worth about 45 to 50 cents a gasoline gallon equivalent. A million BTUs, as we like to sell natural gas at, is about 8 gasoline gallon equivalents. So you can look at that and say, well, there's another $4 for every million BTU I create in renewable natural gas just from that credit. So now we've gone from 4, now we're up to $8 a million BTU if we can get it into the fuel market. So those are some of the ones. That's why we've talked, a number of presenters have talked about compressed natural gas as a driver for these renewable natural gas products, because you can begin to get that added benefit. On the electricity side, you're looking for things in the 11 to 17 cents a kilowatt hour range, and we'd already mentioned, I think the gentleman from CenterPoint had talked about, if you transport the gas in the pipeline out to New England or California, you can begin to see numbers like that that can work. So, again, you have to find higher value marketplaces for this energy, or you have to create the incentive here. These numbers do not look at the potential tipping fee. When you bring that in, these numbers actually begin to go down, because your revenue you're going to generate that's going to drive the economics on the project will be the value from taking the waste and the value from the products that you produce. So we talk about what are some of the potential solutions for our cheap energy market, which we enjoy. I just mentioned promoting compressed natural gas vehicles generates some of these marketplaces. So natural gas refueling infrastructure grants, renewable natural gas production incentives, things like what we've done with the ethanol industry to get it going in the past. If you're familiar with the low carbon fuel standard from the state of California, I know that New England's looking at the same thing. Those can generate these markets as well. Increasing the renewable portfolio standard generates a market for renewable electricity production. That's another place to go. One thing on the electricity generation side is that we do have on the books here in the state of Minnesota the ability to do what's known as net metering. And net metering is if I produce electricity, that I can use it directly and offset that electricity that I would purchase. Unfortunately, our net metering is a little bit on the limited side. Right now, I can do it up to about 40 kilowatts, and if I go from 40, I can go actually all the way up to 1 megawatt. If I go to 1 megawatt, I actually end up only getting paid for what is known as the offset cost, which typically means is that I'm going to sell power to the local utility at that 3 cents we talked about, which would be the wholesale rate, and I'll be buying it back for my own use at 7 cents, which will be the retail rate. So that directly impacts the economics on these projects if you want to look at directly producing electricity. So, as I said, empowering net metering, giving it allowing you to do that at a much larger scale in order to be able to hit the types of projects that we're talking about. Finally, we're going to talk a little bit about technology. And Amanda did a great job kind of starting this off and talking about the different types of technologies. We know we have anaerobic digesters here in the state, and that we've been using them at wastewater treatment plants for a long time. But when we start looking at trying to generate energy from these, whether it's with source-separated organics or some of these higher energy feedstocks that we talked about, what you find is that if you look here in the United States, you don't see a lot of these projects that have been operating, and specifically any U.S. companies that have a long track record of facilities that that are doing and generating energy from these types of feedstocks. So when you start talking to financiers, they want to talk about, they want to see a company that's got a long track record, and they want to see a company that's well established so financially it can handle the risk of being able to put up your project, and you're going to end up looking to Europe for those. One of the things that I personally run into when trying to help clients bring those European technologies to the U.S. is they are developed in a market that is significantly different than what we have here. And what you find is that when they come here, it's very difficult to try to get their technology to be cost-effective in the U.S. market. There's a number of companies that are trying to do that, but I haven't been able to come across one yet that's been able to do that. One of the things that the projects that I have seen kind of moving forward that have European technology, they're all in the waste-to-energy market, so they're looking at source-separated organics. They're taking that tipping fee, which is adding to the overall economics of the project, and they're getting they're going into the compressed natural gas market. So they're working the highest value markets on both sides in order to be able to make sure those projects work. Some of the things with regards to technology solutions, the discussion about the MOU with Sweden and trying to bring that technology and help them understand what our market is, I think is a good step. Reducing financial risk, because that's typically where you run into it. It's the financier that's telling you that you need a company that has this background and has a balance sheet. So ways that we can begin to help reduce that financial risk. We've already talked some about things like low interest revolving funds can help do that. Loan guarantees can help do that. Grant programs can help do that. The other thing is to look at government taking the risk as well, which would be things like public-private partnerships or municipal ownership of some of these projects as well in order to be able to do that. So in terms of looking at all the promoting what we've been talking about here this morning, there's a couple, really three kind of big picture areas that I look at. One is creating a anaerobic digestion market for source-separated organics. I think that's a real target, and it brings in a number of interests within the state. Promoting those energy markets that provide the economics to be able to grow these projects, and then finally developing ways to help manage that financial risk or mitigate it in order to be able to get AD technology that can do these large-scale projects so that we can produce energy that makes a difference within the state with technology that's actually being designed and built right here in the state of Minnesota. And with that, questions.
Thank you. Questions from members? We've learned a lot this morning. You know, part of the charge of the Legislative Energy Commission is we're supposed to be looking at the intersection of transportation and energy issues and agriculture and energy issues, and I think this discussion has furthered the agricultural issue inquiry a little bit, but I think we have a lot more questions to answer going forward. Any other questions from members before we wrap up? There's an update in your folders from our executive director and kind of a status report of things that are going on. And if you have any questions, you can follow up with her afterwards. Otherwise, have a good rest of your Tuesday. We're adjourned.